I have spoken on numerous occasions that the Bible books of Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi form a kind of somewhat overlapping trilogy. And probably Haggai collaborated with Zechariah and Zechariah with Malachi to some level. So as we continue in Malachi, I want to, rather belatedly, I'm afraid, explain to you something significant that goes unnoticed in Bible commentaries. It is this: the new covenant was already known and incorporated into the Jewish religious thought well before the time of Malachi. So it was incorporated into his thought as well. See, the prophet Jeremiah had prophesied several years before those three prophets wrote, a few years before Haggai, but many years before Malachi. So Jeremiah's prophecies had by now been well distributed, and the contents had become known and digested by the Levite priesthood, the sages, the current prophets, and it was taught to some unknown degree by the Levite priesthood, and it was known to the Jewish people. Why is that important? Well, let's read part of Jeremiah chapter 31, starting in verse 30. Here, the days are coming, says Yehovah, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their fathers on the day I took them by their hand and brought them out of the land of Egypt, because they, for their part, violated my covenant, even though I, for my part, was a husband to them, says Yehovah. For this is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says Yehovah. I'll put my Torah within them and write it on their hearts. I'll be their God and they'll be my people. No longer will any of them teach his fellow community member or his brother, know Yehovah, for all will know me, from the least of them to the greatest, because I will forgive their wickedness and remember their sins no more. This is what Yehovah says, who gives the sun as light for the day, who ordained the laws for the moon and the stars to provide light for the night, who stirs up the sea until its waves roar. Yehovah's name, Ode is his name. If these laws leave my presence, says Yehovah, then the offspring of Israel will stop being a nation in my presence forever. This is what Yehovah says, if the sky above can be measured, foundations of the earth be fathomed, then I will reject all the offspring of Israel for all that they have done, says Yehovah. Look, the days are coming, says Yehovah, when the city will be rebuilt for Yehovah from the tower of Hananel to the corner gate. The measuring line will be stretched straight to Garev Hill and then turn to Gua. The whole valley of corpses and ashes, including all the fields as far as Wadi Kidron and to the corner of the horse gate to the east, will be separated out for Yehovah. It will never be uprooted or destroyed again. This is the announcement of the new covenant that Christendom, or Constantinian Christianity, if you prefer, says is the basis for the existence of the church. And generally speaking, the church says it actually had nothing to do with the Jewish people, except in an oblique way. Rather, this new covenant resulted in establishing a new faith for Gentiles. And as a result, the church carries out its preachings and teachings and doctrines as though the process and manifestation of this new covenant was delayed and never arrived or began until Christ's birth. Now, as with so much of the Bible, those who seek to turn snippets of biblical passages into simplistic doctrines often omit the other parts of those passages should those other parts dispute or complicate what it is they want to establish as hard and inflexible truth. And likely nowhere in the Bible can this be more glaringly evident than Jeremiah's announcement of a new covenant. Now notice that in this new covenant in Jeremiah is one, it's given exclusively to Israel and Judah, not to Gentiles. And two, nowhere does this covenant announce a new and different law, but rather only speaks of transferring, of relocating, of the existing law from its external place, written on stone tablets and sheepskin scrolls, into the internal minds and hearts of the Israelites. And three, this untitled new covenant goes on to explain that God upholds the continuing existence and acceptance of Israel as his chosen people and rejects any suggestion that he would ever abandon them or, as Christendom says, invalidate the covenant with Israel and then hand it over to the Gentile church. The prophet relates that only when the universe can be measured and the foundations of the planet Earth be fully understood that God might turn away from Israel. This is, of course, an idiom, much akin to the Western, when hell freezes over, that is intended as a strong expression of something that will never happen because it's impossible to happen. Now, as concerns our study of Malachi, I want to highlight that Jeremiah's covenant of another covenant to be added to the Abrahamic and Mosaic covenants was by now decades old. It had become mostly common knowledge among the regular Jews and well known within the Jewish religious leadership, and so it quite naturally already factored into Jewish thought and expectation. Now, what this means is that when the prophets that came after Jeremiah, like Malachi, spoke in their prophecies of covenants as a general and all-inclusive term, they included this latest covenant from Jeremiah 31. See, for the post-Jeremiah prophets, Israel's covenants were three: Abraham's, Moses's, and Jeremiah's, and no longer two. So even though the culmination, the final acts of all that this new covenant brought with it did not happen until Yeshua came onto the scene, yet elements of it had already begun to manifest, not the least of which was that Jerusalem would be rebuilt after the Babylonian destruction. It is a biblical principle that only when a prophet speaks a prophetic oracle from God does that oracle get set into motion. But the initial inertial push happens immediately. Prophetic oracles do not come about to their fullest fruition all at once. What is predicted always is always more than simply one thing or one event. And so the contents of these oracles roll out step by step, a little bit at a time. And then typically this slow realization of whatever promises the covenants make are not perceived as they happen. Rather, it's only noticed in hindsight. Now consider where we are as God worshipers, standing today in history, and the expectations about the prophetic future that we have. By the time of John the Revelator, all the prophets had spoken. The biblical era of prophecy was over. Now, John's God-given purpose, right near the end of the first century AD, was to help draw a better overall picture, to add sequence and timing of the fuller manifestations of the several prophecies from the Old Testament prophets that would eventually result in a worldwide kingdom of God. John was inspired from heaven with this information, but he was also alive when the prophecies that surrounded and followed the appearance of Messiah actually were fulfilled, which would bring about the seminal event, the main feature of that new covenant spoken by Jeremiah. But despite the usual thought that the main feature was the Messiah himself, it was not. According to Jeremiah's new covenant, the main feature was for God to miraculously put his law, his Torah, into the interior parts of God worshipers. This happened on a Shavuot around 30 AD, shortly after Yeshua had died and risen, around 60 years before John wrote Revelation, which concluded his mission that paved the way for the Holy Spirit to come. See, it was a surprise to those Jews who comprehended what happened, that it turned out that this main feature would manifest itself as the spectacular arrival of the Holy Spirit that would indwell God worshipers. And even more surprising that such an indwelling only happens for those that trust the departed Yeshua of Nazareth for salvation from sins. Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi were completely aware of the new covenant, but they were unaware of how it would play out. And now we in the 21st century, we look at all this information that has been assembled in our Bibles, most of which has been confined to recorded history, as we attempt to figure out where we are in John's timeline concerning the things yet to come. And especially in modern times, because of all these prior prophetic fulfillments, we try to identify world events that just might be some of the milestone events that these prophets of old and that would signal the entry into the end times and the return of the same Messiah and all the horror that will be inflicted on earth and then the eventual joy that comes from it. Therefore, it's important that as we study Malachi, we grasp that within the complex backdrop of his prophetic work, he already has the knowledge of the new covenant because it was no longer new to the Jews. It was at least 100 years old. And the inclusion of Jeremiah's new covenant alongside the Abrahamic covenant and the covenant of Moses was a bygone conclusion. Therefore, just as it is for us as we speak about the end times, even creating some vocabulary to speak about it as time and technology advances, the prophetic messages and vocabulary of the prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, inherently included the reality of Jeremiah's new covenant. And part of that reality was an assurance that despite all of Israel's stumbling and faithlessness and troubles, God still loves them. Yahweh remains their God. They remain his people. Israel will survive and eventually thrive. There will be an operational temple. There will be a fully functioning and revived Levite priesthood, and Jerusalem will be rebuilt better than ever. Now, of course, the Israelites in ancient times didn't know the timing for all this to play out or what exactly it would look like or what situations would be necessary to arise to cause these various predictions to be fulfilled. They only knew that the manifestation of that prophecy of Jeremiah that we call the New Covenant was, as with the other and older prophecies already given, as much underway and in progress as the covenants of Abraham and Moses. This is the perspective by which we are to understand Malachi. And this is also the perspective by which we are to understand the meaning and scope of when Malachi speaks of the covenants. Let's reread the last half of Malachi. We're going to start chapter 1, verse 9. Chapter 1, verse 9. So if you pray now that God will show us favor, what your actions have accomplished is that Adonai Zebaoth asks, will he receive any of you? Why doesn't even one of you shut the doors and then stop this useless lighting of fires on my altar? I take no pleasure in you, says Adonai Zebaoth, and I will not receive an offering from you. For from farthest east to farthest west, my name is great among the nations. Offerings are presented to my name everywhere, pure gifts. For my name is great among the nations, says Adonai Zebaoth, but you profane it by saying that the table of Adonai is polluted so that the fruit and food offered deserve contempt. You also say, oh, it's also tiresome. You sniff scornfully at it, says Adonai Zebaoth. Then you will bring animals that were taken by violence, or they're lame or sick. This is the sort of offering you bring. Am I supposed to accept this from you? Asks Adonai. Moreover, cursed is the deceiver who has a male animal in his flock that's damaged, but vows and sacrifices to Adonai anyway. For I'm a great king, says Adonai Zebaoth, and my name is respected among the nations. Verse 9 was a continuation of Yahweh chastising the Levite priest for offering him defective sacrifices. Already, he has asked the rhetorical question of if their governor would be willing to accept damaged or cheap goods as a gift. Even more, if someone wanting an audience with the governor or king would even get past the front door as his staff examined the gift for its worthiness. And the expected answer to this rhetorical question is, of course, no. So if you can't even get your worthless gift past the front door, let alone to actually set it before the human king, why would you priests think it would be different with God? But even more, if the gift is an attempt to have the king reward you by answering your request for favor about something, why would you expect that a knowingly defective sacrifice would open the ears of God to your prayers? See, the problem with this is that such an attitude had, of course, filtered down to the common people. These priests had virtually encouraged the people to have no reverence or respect for God's altar, upon which their very condition of holiness before God depended. It's appalling to the people who considered themselves leadership that were set apart for God were the ones behind this abomination. See, the thing we must not do is to misconstrue what's being said. This is not saying that the better the gift to God, the better the chance we have for God to pay attention to our needs. God has no needs. He needs no gifts. Gifts are not the way to God's favor. It's the pagan world that believes that their gods must have these gifts to survive or to be comfortable. Listen to Psalm 40, verses 6 through 9. How much you have done, Yahweh my God. Your wonders and your thoughts towards us, none can compare with you. I would proclaim them, I would speak about them, but there's too much to tell. Sacrifices and grain offerings you don't want. Burnt offerings and sin offerings you don't demand. Instead, you have given me open ears. So then I said, here I am, I'm coming. And the scroll of a book, it is written about me. Doing your will, my God, is my joy. Your Torah is my inmost being. See, to obey God, that's the way to God's favor. The offerings, the sacrifices to him were really all the benefit to his earthly worshipers. See, in matters of sin, a sacrifice of an animal that had played no role in a person's sin could be used to satisfy God's insistence on justice and to restore the worshiper to fellowship with him. Who does that benefit? The sinner or God? But when God sets the standard for the offering or sacrifice, mankind has no right to downgrade it to something that costs us less. It's an insult. It's offensive. God indeed has set the standard for our offerings. I'm not even going to waste my time telling it to you because every one of you know what it is. Just as the priests and the common Jews of Malachi, they knew what the standard was. So it's not an issue of education. It's an issue of dedication. And giving or not giving each have their consequences. And giving not what God says, but rather giving somewhat less, has consequences. And trusting Yeshua doesn't relieve us from our responsibilities to give to the measure God has told us. And just as for the Levites and the Israelite people to attempt to defraud God with worthless, lesser, defective gifts was a sin, so it is for believers in Yeshua to do the same. Verse 10 says, why doesn't even one of you just shut the doors? Stop this useless lighting of fires on my altar. I take no pleasure in you, says Yahweh Zebod, and I will not receive an offering from you. See, this verse has been interpreted in some odd ways that are head scratchers. Some claim that this meant that the priests were asking for money to do even the slightest thing, including merely closing the temple doors. Others say that sometimes through laziness, thoughtlessness, this means they would forget to close the temple doors at night. It means neither of those things. It means that since it's not only useless, but it even angers God for worthless and defective sacrifices to be placed on that altar of burnt offering, the priest may just as well close the doors to the temple grounds. In fact, doing that would show some actual reverence for him and be less offensive than what they're doing now. You know, I think we have to consider just how radical of a suggestion God is making here. The idea that the priesthood would take it upon themselves to stop the regular and calendar-driven altar sacrifices normally would be unthinkable. Yet compared to the level of blasphemy they have risen to and the complicit nature of offering defective sacrifices, stopping them altogether would be a better choice. See, when something is that broken, sometimes there's nothing left but to take an action that essentially ends that shattered institution. And you begin again. God already did that once by using the Babylonians to invade Jerusalem and destroy the temple, putting those corrupt priests out of work, then hauling most of them off to Babylon, along with the people they had ruined with their false teachings and man-made doctrines. After a couple of generations passed in Babylon, God reinstituted the temple with a new building and new leaders. It took no time at all for the priesthood to fall right back into its corrupt ways. Part of what happened to the priests was they forgot their reason for existence. They lost their purpose, their goal. The sacrifices had become nothing more than mechanical, vain repetition. And as modern believers, we have to be on guard against our adoption of such an attitude. You know, one of the reasons that I regularly rail against the typical modern expression of worship as we know it in the West is because of this general adoption of a lukewarm, middle of the road, go along to get along brand of God worship. It is said by preachers themselves, there are basically just 8 sermon topics. They are simply given over and over again with cosmetic changes. And almost all are about getting saved or tithing. Little is more popular among pastors than to subscribe to websites where you can purchase pre-packaged sermons. Some complete with a slideshow, even suggested music to go along with it. This is religion. Being there for the sake of being there, empty, fruitless. The goal now is to entertain, not to teach. Rousing music, light shows, comical sermons, coffee shops, amazing sound systems. The aim is to be competitively equal with what the world can offer, not to be a pariah to the world, as was Yeshua's instruction. The objective is to find common ground with secular society, not to offend it, and then off to offer a different and better way. I truly believe that God says that in too many cases, these institutions are broken beyond repair. So stop being part of it. Don't light that altar fire that is only going to offer more substandard sacrifices of praise, which God's going to reject anyway. Harsh? Yes. But no more harsh or radical than what God told those Levite priests to do. Stop the sacrifices altogether. Don't bother with it. They've made it a disgusting waste of time, wood, and the lives of innocent creatures. Now, verse 11 might seem out of place, considering the direction of Malachi's message, or even now not intellectually honest, because God claims that his name is great to all nations. However, this is because verse 11 is a prophetic statement being thrown in here. It's not at all uncommon among prophecies to find God speaking to a prophet in real time, then suddenly throwing in a prophetic statement that can only come later. As of this time in Malachi, Yahweh's name was not considered great in the Persian Empire. After all, nations and kings of that era saw wars as battles between the respective gods of each nation. The nation that won the war, therefore, had a god that beats their foe's god and therefore was the more powerful. And since the Jews were living in a Persian province called Yehud, under the rule of a Persian king, well, then Yahweh would have been seen as weak, unable to bring his people to victory. Therefore, this verse is talking about a future time, the end times, after the apocalypse and Armageddon, when God's name will indeed be great among the nations, all of whom will be defeated by him. A different view about the intent of this passage existed in the early church and was spoken about by Justin and Irenaeus and Clement and Augustine, among others. They said it revealed the nations actually were already worshiping Yahweh and their sacrifices and offerings to their gods. They just didn't know it. Rather, the names of these other gods were just other names for Yahweh. Don't think this is entirely something believed and then abandoned in the past. I personally ran into a situation that involved a statement of the missions board of a very large American church denomination that claimed that Muslims who worship Allah are really worshiping Jesus. They just don't know it. So they encouraged Christians to go and worship with Muslims at their mosques using the name Allah in their prayers. The opening words of verse 11, the way the complete Jewish Bible has it, are okay in the sense that it conveys the proper meaning, but literally, the words are from the rising of the sun even to the going down of the same. This is classic merism. That is, it is a standard literary technique of creating a pair of bookends, each representing the farthest limit, like A and Z. So the technique of merism means this, that, and everything in between, totality. The sun rises in the east, sets in the west. So from an ancient view that thought the earth was flat, then it means from one end of the earth to the other and everything in between. All-inclusive. The meaning is that God says there will not be a nation on earth who hasn't made his name the greatest. Now, maybe this is a good time to remind you that the Hebrew word usually translated as nations is goyim. It also means Gentiles. So when the Bible speaks of nations, it inherently means Gentile nations, which today is all nations on earth except for one, Israel. And it means it that same way here in Malachi. This plays together with the preceding verses about defective sacrifices and offerings. Because since his name will be great in all the nations of the world, which are Gentile in their makeup, how ridiculous is the thought that with the pure worship and offerings of praise he is getting from the Gentiles, that he would be expected to receive corrupted offerings and insincere praise from his own priests and set apart people. Well, after that prophetic vision of the future, God returns to the present. In verse 12, we read, "But you profane it by saying that the table of Yahweh is polluted, so that the fruit and the food offered deserve contempt." Now, verse 12 is a bit difficult to decipher until we realize what it's about. In reality, it's a repetition of verse 7, both having the same essential meaning. The you is the priests. In Hebrew, the word usually translated as profane is mehelalim. Mehelalim. The idea is of desecration. To take something holy and sacred and then subject it to something corrupt and demeaning, thereby defiling it. In modern times, we tend to think of profaning God in the form of our words, by what we say. In reality, it is more meant in what we do. In God's eyes, we profane his name by our behavior. This is what's being claimed here in verse 12. Thus, to use God's name in vain or to use it impiously, it can certainly be called profaning it, yet well more often than not, it's not our speech, but rather in our actions that the profaning occurs, as is the sense of it here in Malachi. Now, what is being described is what God says actually exists in the minds and hearts of the priests, despite all their pretended piousness and hypocrisy. It is Yahweh saying what must be the priest's intentions by offering defective animals on the altar. So he has them saying in response to God's allegations, "Well, we're acting this way because it is the food for Yahweh that's polluted. So it's the food that ought to be held in contempt. Its blemishes aren't our fault. We shouldn't be blamed for it." See, they rationalize that God should hold the defective sacrificial items themselves responsible for their unsuitability. Therefore, he should be offended by the food items, not by the priests who offer it. And when it says that the fruit and the food are to be despised, fruit and food are simply used in an ancient way of speaking about food and meals in general. That is, not fruit as the name of a plant category of edible food that grows on trees. Verse 13 continues that same line of thought. Says, "You also say, oh, it's all so tiresome. Sniff scornfully at it," says Yahweh Zebaoth. "Then you bring animals that were taken by violence, or they're lame or sick. This is the sort of offering you bring. Am I supposed to accept this from you?" says Yahweh. See, it's interesting that the first stanza of this sentence is given with such emotion intensity. Some translations, like the Complete Jewish Bible, add an exclamation point, which is quite the right thing to do. Buried, but not translated, in those first few words is the Hebrew word hine. And when a is used in a verse in the way it is here, it is silent. The word goes unspoken. Normally, when spoken, it means behold, or indeed. Words that scream to the reader, pay attention, it is certain. Here, hine is used unspoken, and it behaves like punctuation. Hence, when translating this unspoken word to English, adding an exclamation point is a must. So we are to imagine some exasperated priest throwing his hands up to the heavens and bellowing, "I am so sick and tired of doing these rituals day after day. I can't hardly stand to do them at all." Yet he's a priest. He's obligated to do his job no matter how much he is bored with it or despises it. And as a result, says God, you sniff scornfully at it. Sniff is an idiom expressing arrogant indifference. And what we take from this is that the priests sniff scornfully at their job of officiating sacrifices, or perhaps at the food offering itself, somewhat like God's accusations in the previous verse. Yet it's fascinating that in very ancient translations, sometimes we find the words are modified to, "You sniff scornfully at me." The "me," of course, is Yahweh. That is, the priest's scornful sniffs are directed towards Yahweh, not so much towards the sacrificial offerings or the job itself. Okay. The Syrian, the Arabic, the Ethiopic texts, among other translations, have it this way. I can't really say which way we ought to take this, who or what it is that's receiving the priest's arrogant indifference. Either way, man, the priests have bad attitudes. Having lost all sense of their purpose, their privilege that God bestowed upon them to be separated, set above all the other Israelites, allowed to do something no one else on earth is allowed to do. The next words say that the priests bring animals for sacrifice that were taken by violence. What does that mean? Taken by violence. The Hebrew word that's being translated is gazal. Gazal. The sense of the word means to rob or to steal, to seize by force. So the word violence that we find in many Bible translations doesn't fit here very well. Nearly certainly the ideas of the priest misappropriating animals from people, virtually stealing them, poaching them from their flocks and herds of local peasants. Now this matches much better the following words that speaks of them using lame and blind animals, which are likely the animals from the priest's own herds. I mean, after all, how simple and without consequence it would be for priests to reject a lame or a blind animal from a common person bringing it for a sacrifice, which they are highly unlikely to bring in the first place. What would motivate them to accept it? It's easy to just say no. Well, by this time in Israel's history, more often than not, a person wanting to sacrifice would literally purchase an animal in Jerusalem from the priesthood's livestock. Not everyone had sheep or cattle. Having but one or two would place that family above most others. So it made more sense and was more convenient to travel to Jerusalem, then go to the temple and purchase one. On the other hand, when it comes to the priesthood's own animals, which had much monetary value to them, sneaking in some of their blind and lame ones to sacrifice from time to time, ones they couldn't sell, would have been tempting, especially when no onlookers would be around. This practice of robbery by the priesthood was not new. Isaiah even speaks about it almost 300 years earlier. Isaiah 61:8, for I, Yahweh, love justice. I hate robbery for burnt offerings. Once again, as we discussed back in our first couple of lessons, this message from God through Malachi boiled down to a reprimand and a call for the priesthood and all Israel to return to authentic, genuine, sincere worship practices because no other kind was acceptable. Sacrifices and offerings that are defective or that cost us nothing because it was stolen from someone else is equally worthless to God. Worship and praise that are rote, mechanical, unthinking ritual habit and performance are worthless to God. It's a waste of energy. It's a self-deception. Let me venture in where angels fear to tread to bring this into the 21st century and make it applicable to us, because it is. Simply showing up for a worship service because that's what you do habitually has little value. A pastor, Bible teacher, preaching or teaching only because it's their profession, pays the bills, has little value. Any act of participation in a communal worship service in which one's heart isn't in it has little value. Better to not come at all. Yeshua takes this to another level. He says that long, windy prayers, especially if they're loud in front of others, has little value. If someone does not pray in sincerity, but rather believes that the value to God resides in the length and eloquence of the prayer, they're mistaken. I mean, just look at the relative brevity, simplicity of the Lord's Prayer as a model. There is no prescribed length of service, length of a prayer, length of a teaching or preaching, because the value of any of these is in the authenticity and genuine purpose to commune with God. The final verse of chapter 1 is this: moreover, cursed is the deceiver who has a male animal in his flock that is damaged, but vows and sacrifices to Yahweh anyway, for I'm a great king, says Yahweh Zebaoth, and my name is respected among the nations. Now, the word curse is regularly used in the Bible, but I think that generally most people don't really know what it means. Pronounced arar in Hebrew, a curse is a potent, sometimes the most powerful decree that a person in authority can give out. In our present context, it is that whomever within a community has transgressed so seriously and blatantly against God or against God's people has, as a consequence, been delivered over to terrible misfortune, and there is no way to escape it. This is the meaning of a biblical curse. The much older Akkadian cognate word aruru, which then evolved into the Hebrew arar, further extends the meaning to include the result of a curse as a paralysis of movement or of other capabilities. An impossible to cross barrier has been erected. I hope you get the picture. It simply doesn't get much worse when God curses someone or something. So when the deceiver who knowingly brings a sacrifice or a damaged male animal from his flock, that person is cursed by God. Whether priest or layman, it's applied. Male animals were always of greater value than female animals in the first place, primarily because so many more female animals were born compared to males. So when the sacrifice called specifically for a male animal, the sacrifice was all the more important, making an unacceptably defective male sacrifice all the more serious. Well, the final words of verse 14 use an unusual epithet for God, calling him great king, Melech Gadol. It expresses absolute universal power and rule. And by tying this to the nations, meaning Gentiles, then this is yet another time that God says that he is as much God of the Gentiles as he is the God of Israel. Now, of course, these final words are in reference not to Malachi's present, but rather to a future time. And despite that, when we realize the very nature of what a pronounced prophecy does, which is to provide that initial inertia for the processes of fulfilling that prophecy to begin, well, then it's easier to understand how God can see his name as being held great among the nations as already accomplished. We'll begin with Malachi chapter 2 next time.